Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
What's happening today on the What Difference Does It Make podcast?
There's lots happening on the What Difference Does It Make podcast, and lots happening with life in general, correct?
We're burning up. It feels like summer here, so that's all I know. And where our guest is, it's snowing, and that is Martha Wainwright, who wrote a memoir. Tell us about this memoir, Holly, please, because I'm not good at describing things.
Okay, well, her memoir is called Stories I Might Regret Telling You, and that should tell you everything you need to know about it. She's from a famous musical family. Her father, Loudon, her brother, Rufus, her mom, part of the McGarrigle sisters. She has many stories to tell. Did you enjoy the book, Dave?
Yeah, this book was great. I've wanted to talk to the Wainwrights. They've intrigued me forever, ever since I saw their Christmas show about 10 years ago. They're just an amazingly talented family, and I wanted to know more about them. And now the book is out, this memoir, and it was everything I wanted to know. But I wanted to know more. So we called Martha into our virtual What Difference Does It Make studios.
So happy we did. She is a sheer delight, and I think I need to be her best friend.
All right. All right. Well, we'll see about that. Why don't we just get right into it? Oh, but before we get right into it, because I might chop up some of these, some things will be missing. So where can they find everything they need to find on our social media network?
You most definitely want to check out the outtakes on our YouTube channel. Just search for What Difference Does It Make podcast, and you'll see lots with Martha Wainwright, and also on our other social media at WDDIM podcast.
Love it. Okay. Now that we got that out of the way, let's get into the studio with Martha Wainwright talking about her book, Stories I Might Regret Telling You, on the What Difference Does It Make podcast. Oh, hey, are you at IRSA? Is that where you are right now?
Yep.
All right. First of all, tell us about IRSA then. What is this?
Well, IRSA is my small music venue slash community center slash wild spot slash everything you want it to be in Montreal. It's in Mile End, and we're, you know, slowly coming back to life after the pandemic. But through the pandemic too, we've been able to do stuff. We've been doing a lot of stuff outside in the lane, and it's a small music venue primarily, but also there's a kitchen. So we have bakers in the morning, and we have events, and I run a kids camp in the summertime. It's kind of a old school hippy dippy, but not so hippy, you know, kind of a little hippy community space, and something I've always wanted to do. And now it's actually happening, and it's a dream slash nightmare come true.
And do you have a studio there also?
I turned the back space into a studio to record some of this record that came out about 6 months ago or last summer. So it's kind of a multi-purpose. Here, I'll show it to you guys.
Ooh, we can get a little tour.
There's like a front room with a lounge area. And then we go through here, and there's a hallway.
It's very homey.
At the back, there's a venue. It's very homey. Yeah. There's lots of pictures of the McGarrigles up because we did a little event where we had the McGarrigles. There's a kitchen where we do our cooking in here. And then there's this music space right here. And we do all sorts of stuff in here. We set up tables or it's standing. We have dance parties. We have this class. We do, you know. So it's kind of as I described, right?
That's so great. Are the kids camps, is it like artsy kids camp?
Well, yeah, because I'm involved. So, yeah, I mean, I do music at the end of the day. But we go out to the parks a lot, you know, because I don't want 12 kids running around here all day. So we, you know, we gather, and then we have snack, and then we go out to the park and do something and go to the pool or go play basketball or go for a walk. And then we come back and do some music and then go out again. You know, it's very whatever the kids kind of want to do, except they have to do music at some point. So I torture them with music.
That's good.
That's awesome. The place looks great. And I have already put it first on my list. We were going to come up to Montreal, and we live in LA. That was going to be our anniversary trip. And I already decided it's going to be my first stop.
Oh my God. Right.
Is your camp much like your music video we saw for Love Will Be Reborn? Is that what's going on there? Just kids playing medieval games or what?
Exactly. I give them all swords when they come down and every morning, weapons.
Okay, so we could talk a little bit about Love Will Be Reborn. And actually, the video, there's two boys in there. Who are these boys?
They're my kids.
They are. Okay.
They sleep in the forest, so I see them every month. Nice. They're my two kids. And They originally, you know, I had gotten some treatment for the song, you know, by a director or production house. I mean, videos nowadays are not, they're not as expensive as they used to, you know, they're just kind of there for YouTube or whatever. And so I got some treatment that was like pretty boring, and I'm supposed to be like in a log cabin or something. I was like, okay, I don't really understand, but whatever. And then I was around the dinner table with my kids, and my son was really into the Legend of King Arthur at the time, and he's like, can we be in it? Can I be King Arthur? I was like, okay, that's better. So I just called up the director and said, scratch what you had before, new plan, my kids are starring in the video, and it's going to be a medieval thing. Sorry, you gotta make it happen.
Brilliant.
Great idea. Love seeing the kids.
Yeah.
I cried only one tear for us today, and I will wipe it away before the day breaks. And there is love in every part of me, I know. But the key is falling deep into the snow. So when the spring comes, I will find it, and I'll lock my heart to unwind it, and love will be reborn.
First of all, after reading the book, it was nice to see the title of your album is Love Will Be Reborn. Like, okay, Martha's good. She's checking in with everyone. Was this your pandemic album?
Project.
You know, I wouldn't have thought it was a pandemic album, but at the same time, it really did. I think the album is really about going from quite dark to light, you know, yeah. And I'd started writing the songs about 5 years ago, and it was the first record that I made in 5 years. So it's a long time since my last one. It's really like a real true midlife album, really deep, right in the middle of my 40s. It came out of, you know, a really difficult divorce with everything that entails, you know, with court and all sorts of terribleness and kind of just really rough, and then finding some really hopeful things at the end, including a new relationship, but also just in general, finding a way to sort of shed the past a little bit. And then it timed out that I was making it during the pandemic, which made sense. And we were able to, whenever there was kind of a moment where me and the musicians were allowed to be in the same room together, we kind of would go in for 2 or 3 days, whenever that was sort of happening on the COVID schedule, depending on what city you're in. And then I was also able to hand it to the producer, who's this incredible producer called Pierre Marchand, Canadian producer. And he was just holed up in his house in the Laurentians, which is this mountain area outside of Montreal. And he just worked on it, and I would send him tracks, you know, that I would record, and he pulled it together, I think, really beautifully. So a lot of the feeling of the record is, you know, coming out of a difficult time, sort of a spring-like feeling. So that timed well, I think how people are wanting to feel and wanting to find that feeling.
And then the book is like the capper to that.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that the book is, you know, really kind of gets into that kind of darker stuff. The book took a long time to write and really tells the story that a lot of people already know about me, or a story that's been told before by journalists, but in my own words. And I think in my sort of how I you know, things that I felt were important to say.
You color in a lot of the, you know, people may know the story, but they don't necessarily know your full vision of the story.
Yeah, and also, I mean, there was a lot. I wrote a lot. It took many years. I wrote a lot down. I took a lot out because I also was like, I don't really need to say this about this person. Or I think we get the gist, if you know, with what was happening. I don't need think we need another story with me getting shit faced. You know, like we got that. You know, we don't need another example of my dad not being great. I love him. We know that. But I wanted to, I think, touch on things that many of us in our families have experienced, you know, whether that's divorce and separation, whether that's complicated relationships between siblings. And then some other subjects that I think for women are particularly taboo to talk about, things like abortion and drugs and alcohol and feeling and how you feel about yourself. And although the book is quite personal, I do think a lot of people will hook in on it in a way where they don't feel it's completely foreign to them.
You told it in such a way, in such a matter-of-fact way, but allowing for the complexities of the relationship.
Right. Well, it's short, you know, like, I mean, it's concisely written because a lot of the stuff is kind of hard. I weighed every sentence and, you know, every word, which I had no experience doing because I'm as a songwriter, it's a totally different process, you know, so I wanted to talk about stuff. It was never going to be a book about gardening or, you know, recipes. It was always going to be about my family to some extent and me, but I wanted to say something too.
For me, it kind of seems the same way with songwriting because, you know, I listen to Loudon's music a lot and he just lays it all out in the line. He tells the story. He tells exactly how he's feeling. It's like a memoir. Everything right. that comes out. I mean, I think this is how the Wainwrights write, or, you know, maybe this is like cathartic. Well, I mean, you said stories I might regret telling you. So it was probably easy to just kind of delete some stuff.
Yeah, I had to delete some stuff. I mean, the process was really different because, you know, when you're writing a song, you know, you're writing in a way where it's, you know, it's about you and your family. Are you in this guy? Are you in this girl or whatever? But once the listener hears it in that moment, accompanied with the music and the space where they might be at in their lives, it's automatically theirs. You know what I mean? It's for them, you know, I think, you know, to identify with, to feel, to interpret how they want. I think with writing the book, you know, in black and white on the page, you know, forever there, printed on the shelf, you know, not changing, it's more concrete. And I find with music, you know, I've sung some of the same songs for over 20 years, 25 years, and they can take on new meaning. Some of my old songs, you know, when I sing them at 45, it's different when I wrote them at 25, you know, and so there's a more of a fluidity. And of course, with the poetry of music and the sound, with instrumentation, you can change the tempo, you can change the tone. It depends on how your voice is happening at that moment. Whereas the book seems something that sort of has to be sort of chosen to say, really, as I said, kind of weeded through in the editing process. Also, I have two kids, you know, so I wanted to protect them. You know, I don't want to have to censor myself, but I didn't want them to pick up the book and read, you know, trashing their dad. That's not going to be good. I had to really kind of think a lot about it. A lot of stuff I put on the page that I really liked, but I just was like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to cry.
Yeah.
So, did you keep an archive? Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Did you have any family members read any of it before you published it?
A little bit, not too much, you know, because I just felt I didn't want to have to answer to them. You know, it's my story, and especially with my family, where I've always had to sort of literally sort of fold them into my own life. I mean, we all have to do that to an extent with our families, but I've had to do that in a public way, you know.
Right.
I definitely had my Aunt Teddy, who the book is dedicated to my dad and to his sister, Teddy, who died in 2020. She would read drafts and, you know, she would give me her advice, but I didn't really want too much advice. What I did is I would call people up and sort of interview them and say, am I remembering this correctly? Did that happen? Did that not happen? Kind of fact check. And especially with Rufus, you know, because I talk a little bit about our childhood and then I go into some stuff about how our mom felt about his sexuality and some of the stories that I remember as a young person or that I had heard. And I was like, this is sort of my interpretation. Is that correct? And he would say, you know, yes, that's correct. And so he knew what was in there, you know, just by me asking those questions and me talking to him about it. My father knew what would be in the book because I had to get clearance for the use of some of his lyrics from songs. And so just by needing that clearance, and I needed the clearance in writing. So it wasn't just like, hey, Dad, thank you. Can I have this? Like giving him some wine so he forgets he gave me clearance. You know, so he knew what was going to be spoken about. And I talked to him about it. And I said, look, these are all things that people know. You've written about them in your book. You've sort of expressed your side of the story. This is going to be sort of my side of the story. It's going to be a little different. But he read it after the fact and accepted and actually very much enjoyed it. So I was really relieved for that.
Did you feel the same way about his book?
I felt the same way about his book in different ways. Loudon's book touches on a lot of stuff, but it really kind of stays in a safe way, you know, and it's really more about some of the music aspect of it and the family stuff. You know, I think it's how he can express it. You know, that's how he does it, you know, and we're really different in that way. I sort of like kind of go deep down into it and sort of get into the swampy bits. And I think that honestly, he appreciates that about me. I'm going to say that. I hope that's the case. You know, I read some of his book. I didn't love the chapter about my mom, so I closed up. But then I went back and I enjoyed some other chapters a lot.
That seems healthy.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it was funny, you know, I just ran into Teddy Thompson, you know, whose dad is Richard Thompson. Yeah. And his mom is Linda Thompson. Richard wrote a book a few months back. It came out, I think, or last year. Teddy was like, you know, saying that he was like reading through the book to try and find something new. And no, it's the guy that we know, that we all know and that he loves and knows, but there wasn't any big reveal, you know, in the book.
Yeah. That's what everyone wants to see. Really enjoying our talk with Martha Wainwright, but we cut this in half so we can make some money. Money, 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 money. All right. We'll be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners. Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our guest, Martha Wainwright. Okay, so we noticed in the book that sometimes you refer to your dad by his name and sometimes you refer to him as dad.
Yeah. Well, that's that. And I do that, I think, with my mom, too. I say Kate a lot. I mean, I use their names in the book. I would never use their names to their faces or in talking about them to other people as my parents. But that being said, when I talk about them as artists, of course, that's how I refer to them. But I remember once calling my dad Loudon when I was speaking to him when I was like 14, and he was not happy. He got really pissed off and he said, don't call me that. I also, you know, I'm like 45, I'll be 46. When I'm on the stage talking about music and these great songs, do I want to say, my dad's song says that? You know, I'm like, no, it's Loudon. We know him as Loudon, you know, and he's an artist. And I felt the same thing about my mom. She wanted me to think of her as my mother, of course, but she was also this incredible artist, you know, Kate McGarrigle. And that's really worth something, too. And I appreciate that about both of them.
Let's go to when you were 14 for a second. Because I guess.
Okay, no problem. I'm just going to turn into my 14 self. All the wrinkles are going to go away.
Yeah. I mean, it is a transitional time in a young person's life. So you found yourself in New York City with just your dad. It was just you and your dad in Lower East End. How do you think that shaped your life? Just you and your dad in New York City in, was it the early 90s or?
Early 90s. Yeah. Well, I think for me, it was a great time, even though turning 14 was hard and being rejected by guys was hard or whatever. But I really changed. My eyes were opened up to New York City. I'd grown up in Montreal. I'd gone to New York for long weekends and in the summertime and at Christmas. It was still really a big deal to move to New York City and to have that incredible experience. And this, I went to Friends Seminary, which is, I was a pretty fancy school with all these kind of famous kids. And the kids were a lot more mature than I was. You know, they were kind of advanced. So I was just like overwhelmed with that and dealing with all of that stuff. I think for my dad, in contrast, it was a lot harder for him. I didn't know what the big problem was. I was just acting out as a teenager. But by the end of the year, he kicked me out. And that kind of hurt my feelings a little bit. I mean, he kicked me out. He just sent me home. He's like, okay, I'm done. But I think he had never brought up any of his children, really. And so I think for him, it was a big shocker. I got so close to him, I think, in a way, and maybe a little bit under his skin. So I wouldn't have changed it, but I don't know if it was easy for him. And it definitely changed my personality. I mean, I left Montreal kind of a nervous, weird 13-year-old, and I came back kind of much more savvy, smoking and drinking and being attitudinal and terrible.
As 15-year-olds are.
It seemed perfectly normal to me.
Hey, Rags. And then discovering his songs that were about you during that time, and what you mentioned in the book that you kind of on your own just to kind of discover to learn about his life, and then all of a sudden you're a character in his songbook.
Guess by getting close to the songwriter, like a writer, this happens, you know, then you end up in their book or you end up in their song, and that doesn't always sit pretty with everybody. I always appreciated, especially as a kid, hearing my name in songs like Happy Birthday Martha, which is about him not being at my 5th birthday. And when I listen to it now, it's terribly sad and depressing and horrible in a way. But when you're young, just hearing your dad say, I love you, I can't be there for your birthday, and saying your name over and over, it felt good. So I didn't understand the whole concept of the song, but nor did I want to, or should I? I didn't want to make it a problem as I started to hear more from my mother, what their marriage was really like or whatever. You know, then I started to sort of understand more the subtleties and or the not so subtle subtleties in the songwriting. And it is a way that we speak to each other. It's a language. And I think the language of music is as good as any. I appreciate it. And I think also for someone like Loudon, who is not, you know, the most open and free person, and he's a little nervous, that's how he has to do it. And if that's how he has to do it, then my ears are opened and I will interpret that his lyrics as I see fit, as I wish to, yeah.
By the way, just going back to 14 years old and moving to New York and living with your dad, that alone, never mind the dynamics, that age alone is hard for a kid. You know, it takes its own toll. And then, like you said, being sent back at the end of it.
Yeah, I think that was the hardest part, was what, you don't want me to stay. I think that when you haven't brought up your kids on a daily basis, it's not easy. And I know that my dad, the life that he chose was more a life of work. And that's what it is. I don't know. I think it's okay. I know it is okay because it is.
Yeah.
But accepting that as a 45-year-old is one thing, accepting it or understanding it as a 14-year-old.
I definitely had a lot of sad feelings about it, as I did, you know, about, you know, my brother being successful or skinnier and better looking, or as it added to the pot of insecurity and teenage angst, certainly, you know. One of the things that I noticed with my family, and I think a lot of families hopefully can do this, is that whatever sort of conflict there's been, you know, even though some of it's been quite intense, there's been children not wanted, there's been divorce stories, there's been a certain amount of rejection, there's always been an incredible amount of love and support around it, in a way where I always know that if I have a problem, I can go to my dad and talk to him about it, that he is all ears, that he's quite sensible. That's a lot, you know, that's a lot.
Got to bring a lot of comfort.
Because we're in LA, there were a couple trips to LA that seem memorable. Yeah. Let's start off with the most innocent one. That was when you went to Disneyland, but you were at the Chateau. And was Grammy week. Was that your first experience with like the industry, or like to learn about
I mean, that was my first experience with the big industry, you know, because I had been exposed to all sorts of folky people coming into our house with their banjos and their mandolins and their weirdness and their kind of sweet whatever. And then, but of course, I was listening to Cyndi Lauper and the Eurythmics and Prince, and that's what I was listening to, you know. And so to then be kind of, you know, when you're a kid and you kind of only half understand what's happening, you're like, okay, we're gonna go to LA, that's gonna be fun, we're gonna go. And then you get there and you're like, oh my god, it's real, you know. And for being from Montreal, you know, it's a big, it looks very different, you know. Let's say what I remember is seeing how kind of happy and excited my mother was to be there too, and to be in that space and to feel among her people in a way, in terms of just people in the industry. And I think that was really, that's really meaningful. And I know that feeling where you want to, you know, you get there to the festival and, you know, you want to feel part of it, you know, and you want your kids to know that you're a part of it too. But then seeing Cyndi Lauper in the hot tub, very nervously wondering if she's going to get the award. I remember distinctly seeing Annie Lennox come into the Chateau Marmont, into the vestibule area. And it was just kind of very overwhelming for me. And I was just, I mean, I think clearly Rufus got the bug, because he ended up moving to LA when he was 21 or something. I mean, that's really been his musical home, is Los Angeles, since the beginning, through Van Dyke Parks and Lenny Warnker at DreamWorks originally. So I think he must have clapped that early on for him. And I ended up going more to New York when I was 21. It's such a magical, when I was going to title the chapters, I didn't end up titling them, because I had titles for some and then titles for others. And I was just coming up with these crappy titles. So I was like, you know, let's just not title them. But I did have a chapter called I Love LA, because I just always adored it. And maybe it's because I got to be right away exposed to kind of the greatness of it. So, you know, going there for a Grammy week, you know, and then going there and hanging out at Stephen Still's house, and but then going to Huntington Gardens, and then hanging out with some really kind of groovy people in Echo Park and Silver Lake, like in the late 90s. And, you know, seeing different aspects of it that wasn't just sort of only Hollywood Boulevard. I never felt that. And I also because I was never really in the film industry, I was only connected to the music industry and the kind of more sort of a grittier, artier side of it. I always just adored it and still do.
Were you with Rufus when he was being wined and dined for his first record deal? That was kind of when you returned to LA and got to hang out?
That was when I returned to LA and I got to meet Lenny Warnker and also John Bryan, who was producing the record, which I know was, I talk about this in the book, kind of a difficult process, but what a great product they made. It was kind of worth it, I think, in many ways. But, you know, we went to the Ivy, which I talk about a little bit, which I don't know, I'm sure it's not as in favor, but at the time it was probably a pretty big deal. I think that was also, I hate to put it this way, but it did always feel like there were these things that would always kind of happen that made me feel, that would set me back in a way, whether it's my dad saying you got to go back home after living with him for a year. Or I think, you know, Rufus having an incredible success by my standards, because music is quite out there, you know, and he was this lanky gay guy at the piano. It seemed kind of really amazing that he would be given as much support as he did, because he's so great also. So that of course makes sense. You know, I just sort of was like, oh, how am I going to do this myself? And I feel like there was already the two parents that were very like critically acclaimed, although not huge stars, but critically acclaimed. And then Rufus became very critically acclaimed. And I think that by that time I was already writing songs, but it was like, well, we can't have another one that's good. You know what I mean? That's going to be the kind of the crappy runt. We have to deal with somehow.
Well, you did touch on that with your mom, who said, what do you want to do, sing and dance for a living? Is that, that was the quote that you said? I mean, but you took that as like, yes, I do. Is that?
Yeah, I do. But I realize, I think being surrounded by these people who had very distinct styles and were very creative, that I was going to have to do the work and craft the craft. And it was not as easy or obvious for me because I kind of lacked a little bit of confidence. I think my musical style was a little bit like confused. I liked it, but it was sort of like, I think for record labels early on, they were like, you know, what is this? Is this kind of country? Is this rock? This is not pop. You know, you're kind of, you're not, you don't dress a certain way or you don't look a certain way. You know, I think it was hard for me to be put into a box, and lots of producers wanted to work with me, you know, like Rick Chertoff, for instance, who had done Cyndi Lauper's record and Joan Osborne and, you know, had huge success. And I'd be like, yeah, I should do that. And I would get into the studio with them and just kind of fuck it up in a way. I just didn't want to change my songs. You know, I just didn't want to do it. I was just difficult. And I was kind of, I was nice, but I was like, no, this is the weird chord. I was going, it was going to take a minute. Then I really started going to New York more and hanging out more on the Lower East Side. And it took time to find the style. I needed to do 1,000 shows or whatever and really gain the confidence to walk around with the guitar. And I felt like I needed to pay my dues, maybe.
Like everyone.
Yeah.
Do you want to touch on that? The one song, I think you said your first good song, Bloody Mother Fucking Asshole. Do you want to, what is it about that song for you that like hit all the right notes?
Poetry is no place for a heart that's a whore. And I'm young and I'm strong, but I feel old and tired, over fire. And I've been poked and stoked, it's all smoke, there's no more fire, only desire for you ever you are. For you ever you are. Oh, you say my time here has been some sort of joke, that I've been messing around, some sort of incubating period. But when I really come around, I'm cracking out. And you have no idea, no idea how it feels to be on your
I think that the song, you know, the song is called Bloody Motherfucking Asshole because that's a phrase that I say over and over at the end of the song. As I was writing the song and it was just about done, the words came out. But the song, the words that were before are very good too. They're just the words at the end really packed the punch. It was very subversive to do that in many ways, especially from a white girl in her, you know, early 20s with an acoustic guitar. I think it's kind of surprising and quite edgy for that sound, for the guitar, you know, acoustic-y kind of folky sound or whatever. But the song, or the body of the song is really about wanting to be taken seriously by the industry, taken seriously by my dad, taken seriously by myself, you know, and wanting to be heard, you know. And so I think it was really a woman song, a young woman song. I think that that really has resonated with young women. Even to this day, everyone who listens to it, and I remember seeing this when I would play it, you know, they would kind of close their eyes and sing along. It's like, you understand right away, it's like, this song has nothing to do with me. You know, this has to do with whatever that person is who's going, you know, with their eyes closed, singing it out loud. They are having their own connection with it. And that to me seemed to be the power of the song, and that I felt lucky that it kind of came through me, but it seemed like it was a feeling and an idea that a lot of us have. Yeah.
That's what you touched on in the difference between a book and a song right there. That was. Suddenly it's not your song anymore. It's whoever, everyone's interpretation of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And probably don't know it as you're writing it or, you know, singing it in the beginning, but now
No, you know, you think it's you're just sort of trying to find words that are meaningful, that rhyme somewhat, you know, that sound good with these chords that are rhythmically interesting and that are expressing the pain or the sadness or the anger or the happiness or whatever that emotion is in your chest. You know, what is it that I want to, that I can put into words that is not just crap or pointless? Or, you know, I've never written a song to, I think probably like most songwriters, maybe up in the 90 percentiles of it, you know, they're writing songs because they want to write a hit or they want to have success or they want to, because that's really a motivation. And unfortunately, I've never had that feeling. I mean, I wish I did. Yeah. I really did, you know.
You say you write like 5 songs a year. Is that your average now?
Yeah, I don't write a lot of songs. I mean, I'm mopping floors at my music venue most of the time and getting my kids into high school and trying to get them to do their homework and traveling around a lot playing gigs. And then I start to get really extra nervous. I mean, why am I so upset? And I realize, okay, I need to sit down and write a song because this is the thing that's going to keep this ship afloat.
Do you start to relate to Kate more often now? Because like, oh, okay, this is what my mom had to go through. I mean, it's kind of the same situation or similar, you think?
Well, it's similar. I mean, I've returned to her, I returned to Montreal to have my second son. And so I've been here now 8 years, which was maybe, you know, it's not like a great career choice necessarily to go from New York to Montreal, but it was better for the kids, certainly. And also my family are here and I inherited my mom's house when she died. And so to me, it's very, very meaningful. You know, she died when she was so young, she was 63, you know, and so I felt like I also have a responsibility to continue her legacy a little bit through her music and to, you know, I wanted to keep her close to me. I do feel finally with this book and writing down, you know, what happened to her and telling that story a little bit, I think has helped me to sort of finally kind of really let go, though, to really close a chapter on that and sort of look more to the future.
Were you journaling at all at the time, or did you have to like go back in time?
I'm so bad. I've tried journaling and I get like a crappy sentence and then it's just like a list of what I need to do or like, you know, what shopping list or something, you know, or a doodle or something, or a phone number, pay tickets. Yeah, that's my journal. Taxes? You know, so no, it was terrible. So I had to sort of start, and I started in kind of a harsh place in this book. You know, we sort of start at the beginning. Yeah. But I felt that was the start. And then I just sort of go from there and just try to sort of remember feelings that I had, people that I remember telling a little bit the story of my parents, you know, because I knew that people wanted to read a little bit about Rufus and Loudon and Kate, you know, so I felt the responsibility, you know, that I had a structure in that way, but I filled it in with things that I felt were important to me.
Did you have to talk to old boy? I know you didn't mention it to other people.
There's only one guy that I had to call, you know, when there's always a legal team who goes through something, and a lot of them's like, you got to call this person to say you're taking poppers, and they're there and they're doing poppers. Drug and alcohol, like drug related, because illegal substances. And okay. Stuff.
Did anybody say no?
Everyone was fine. I mean, most of those people are sober, you know, so people who are sober in general are happy to have it be talked about, you know, and kind of show that side of it. And they're happy to be alive, basically. There was one guy who I wanted to say something about him, and it was in the book, and he said, no, I don't want you to put it in. But that was it.
Okay.
And also, I didn't, you know, I'd written a lot down about Brad Albetta, who's a great musician, who's my ex-husband and the father of my kids. But I would go back and read it, and it was just shitty. You know, it was just too depressing or too crappy. And I was like, you know what? I might not feel this way in 5 years, and my kids don't want me to do this. Yeah. You know, so I just sort of took it out. I left a few little jabs in because I felt I had to, but, you know, pretty minimal.
Yeah, you could read into it if you want to, but it wasn't super harsh. And you did a couple of, you did say, and I don't need to say any more about that.
Yeah.
Because you're part of, you know, music royalty, you hung out with a lot of kids of also royalty. And it's because of their last names. I was wondering, like, when you're younger, like, and just before you became an artist, like, I don't know if any of these other artists, like, do we have to use our last names? Or did you ever want to be like, you know, Princess Martha or, you know, like someone.
Somebody asked me recently because they want to do a Skype. I think I have a Skype coming up or something. And I was like, what's my Skype name? I couldn't remember. And I was like, oh, yeah, my Skype name is Gabby Holton, which is, I think, my stripper name, which is like my middle name in the first street I lived on. But I definitely went through a period where I didn't. I wanted to try having another name. And then I realized that that would make it even harder. In a way, maybe it would have made it easier. But, you know, I'm from a folk tradition, and I guess I never thought that my parents were so famous that it would be so impossible to usurp them in any way. I finally have now after 25 years. It wasn't as intense as being Sean Lennon or Harper Simon or whatever. I mean, and all those guys have a sort of father-son problem that I don't really have. So, you know, I've seen a lot of people, sons of, you know, have to struggle with, you know, how they're going to make it or whatever. And it just takes time. You got to pay your dues. You can't just hitch a ride to your parents' wagon and automatically expect to be in the same place in the rock and roll tower of song. It's a moment. Good luck, Adam Cohen. It's not going to happen.
And your own kids, your kids now have a propensity for song?
Yeah, totally. One of them, the eldest Arcangelo, has a band called Motor Skills. That's basically what Ursa has been of the pandemic, is a rehearsal spot for his band. And he totally has the bug and he plays bass like his dad, which I'm sort of like dreading and also going, well, that could be good because, you know, it's not that, you know, it could be good for him because it brings him a lot of joy and a lot of happiness. And my other son has totally rejected this kind of music and is like into, you know, hip hop and rap and everything that is not folky or whatever, and can't stand my music. But every once in a while when I'm on stage, he kind of climbs on, he walks, he's eight. He gets up on stage without me asking and sort of stands between me and the microphone to stop me in a way. You know, he doesn't like it. But at the same time, I look down and be like, you're actually on stage, so there must be something you like about this, you know? So I think he's going to surprise us all and sort of come at it a different way.
Hip hop and folk, it's the same. It's kind of the same. Comes from the same.
It's the importance of the words and also being trying to tell the story of your generation.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. I'm going to tell them that.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh,
no,
great.
No.
Right.
You can't
get that mother-son dynamic.
Mom is always uncool. That you can't be cool in their eyes ever, no matter what.
Okay, but I am curious, is there anyone in your family, even on the periphery, that isn't in the arts? Do you have any accountants or?
No, that's not allowed. We killed them all. We bring them back and we incinerate those ones.
Yeah.
There's a couple of cousins who really can't sing and it's really weird. when you're at Christmas or whatever, or, you know, the tribute show and they're there standing on stage like singing along and you're just like, what's going on? They don't know. You sit back there, over there.
Was Teddy a singer, or is that why she went
into... No, she was a terrible singer, but she was the first to admit it. She didn't say, she was not artistic-y in an obvious way at all, but she did the other thing, which was to be Loudon and the Roaches' manager for 25 years, and then Rufus and my manager for a while, and then she produced the Christmas shows as well as the Kate tribute shows, and she was the one who was like holding it all together.
Yeah, she puts the circus together. That's the hard part.
Counting the money and trying to make it. I remember one Christmas show we did, and we had a merch table. I guess it was cash, and it was a big Christmas show. And there was a lot of people there, and there was all this cash. And she was so excited, you know. Like I remember, like chain smoking cigarettes and a big glass of wine, and you know, she was like really excited about the money. And then we had this after party, and we were all hanging out at the after party, lots of wine and everything else. And we were in one room, and then she was staying upstairs. It was like a big Airbnb that we're all staying at, and she was at her room upstairs, and she said, Martha, come upstairs. I was like, oh my god, what are we gonna do, like coke? No. Come upstairs into the room. And she had, I guess she, it was exciting to her, she had like laid down the cash on the mattress as a sort of joke, and I was like, that's it? It took up like a quarter of the mattress, and it was like a little like sporadically placed, and I was like, this is not good.
But she was so happy, and I want to ruin it for her.
But in that way, the folk music was not like the hip hop music.
Yeah, that's hip hop is where the money is. Okay, got to follow the money. That's what your son's going to do. Follow the money. Jane Arden said in your book, she can't wait for volume two. Is that in a plan?
Well, it would be good. I would like to, you know, and I don't want to wait another gazillion years, but you know, I do have some other thoughts, and it's definitely because I have kids in school, you know, it's a good thing for me to do, to write rather than to be on the road all the time, playing gigs and touring. So I'm thinking about it. I have some ideas.
Oh, cooking up something. All right.
You can also write about a fictional musical family.
I just saw a light bulb go off in her head like that. I think you hit on something, Holly. Is there one song from your mom that means the most to you? Or is there anything that when you think of your mom, you think of a song or something?
Well, I think one of my mom's most well-known songs is a song called Mendocino. Wow. And I think it's such a beautiful song because it's a love story, sort of. It's about her actually running off with a guy while she was actually married to my dad. I think there was a lot of that going on. But it's about time and love and space and freedom and youth. And we have these big moments with the ocean and the redwood forest and the sun and the sun setting and the sun rising, but also these ideas of where we are on the planet and as people, you know, trying to make sense of it. And I just love that song.
We'd like to bring Linda back on now to sing a song with us about California. She knows all about it.
I came of age when first I started roaming, and the trees grow high in New York State, and they shine like gold in the autumn. Never had the blues from whence I came, but in New York State I caught.
I do too. So is Linda Ronstadt. Have you sung that song with all three, like the three of you on stage, or Emmylou and Linda?
No. I never had the opportunity to sing with Linda. She did come to a couple of shows of mine in the Bay Area, which was so amazing to have her there. And my God, I sang better when she was in that room. I was like, God damn it, Linda Ronstadt's here. I'm gonna work hard tonight and try and show her what I got, because I'm so amazed and moved by her.
Let me ask also about background singing. You said you didn't enjoy it. It's like 20 Feet from Stardom. That was the documentary. But
yeah, 30 Feet, I get it. It was a great documentary. I mean, I loved backup singing for Rufus, but it was really not what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I had the opportunity to sing with a lot of people doing backup. But I, you know, really quickly, I would end up sort of changing my part and trying to stick out and getting a little closer to the front of the stage. It was pretty obvious that I was not backup singing material. You know, I'm not against it. I like singing with people. You know, I'm a folky too, so I like the idea of singing together. But my years as a backup singer are over.
Okay, fair enough. That's good. We're the better for it, right? Okay. Well, okay. Go back to camping and doing your.
I have to go back to my life, actually, guys.
Yeah. Okay. Enjoy your life. Yeah.
I have to go back to the cold. Actually, I have some more.
Oh, sorry.
For Ursa now, for the band's coming in.
Who's playing tonight? Who you got on the marquee?
We have a bunch of young musicians from McGill College who are doing a jam for Justice. So they're gonna. trash the place and raise money for a good cause. They have different. I don't think tonight the money is not going to the war tonight, but I think that some part of it is, and so it's going to be lots of young people in here. I'll have to get someone to do the.
So you're not going to take all the cash and spread it along the bed and just like, look how much money we made.
No, it's going to be like some, it's not like that.
Yeah.
But it's a feel good. You'll feel,
it's a feel good.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a good journey. Yeah. So the journey continues. That's wonderful. It's wonderful to talk to you. The book is amazing. I loved it so much. And as someone also said in the book, it's too short. We need more. So Stories I Might Regret Telling You, Martha Wainwright. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both very much. I had fun.
Oh, we did too.
Us too.
All right. Cheers.
Thank you, Martha.
Bye. Stay cool.
Yeah, we're trying. I know you will.
You too.
All right. All right, Holly. So still want to be best friends with Martha?
She is the coolest, the most fun. She's smart. She's talented. Yes, she's just cool.
Okay, if we want to stalk her, we can go to Ursa in Montreal, and we know where she is. So, yeah, we can find her at any time.
You can bet I will.
Okay, good. Okay, so...
Sorry, Martha, if that scares you.
Stalker alert. Stories I Might Regret Telling You is the book. Her new album is called Love Will Be Reborn. I also recommend listening to that, checking that out, because it's really good. And it's actually, after reading the book, it was kind of good to listen to the album, because it's where she is now, and she's in a much better place than where she was when she was much younger.
You can see them as going in tandem, right?
I agree. I think Martha agreed with you when you said that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So that you guys are best friends. I mean, you guys agree on everything. Yes. Wonderful. We have new episodes every Friday. You never know who's going to show up. So make sure to subscribe, write a review, tell us how much you love What Differences Make. Let us know what we missed out on our interview or any experiences with Martha. We love any input is fun input.
And check us out on social media at WDDIM Podcast and on YouTube at What Difference Does It Make Podcast.
That sounds great. Hey, and also we are a member of Pantheon Podcast.
Pantheon has some fabulous music-related podcasts, so definitely check them out.
Until next Friday, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.